This is a crime that is chronically underreported. And I think today, survivors are breaking the silence because we have done a lot of work in tackling stigma. Shame and stigma constitute a major obstacle that explains why survivors do not come forward.
Medieval crimes are being committed.
I come with clean hands.
Victims of horrific crimes want justice.
We don't have anything better than this.
This is Asymmetrical Haircuts, your international justice podcast, with Janet Anderson and Stephanie van den Berg. This episode was produced in partnership with justiceinfo.net.
All rise.
Hi, Janet.
Hi, Steph.
Last week, there was a super interesting meeting of prosecutors from all around the world who were sharing their knowledge about how to prosecute conflict-related sexual violence, or CRSV.
Yeah, thanks very much for the acronym, because I think this episode is going to be a bit acronym heavy. We were actually able to sneak in briefly. This was at the Peace Palace in The Hague. And what really impressed me was the level of expertise around the room and the really strong commitment that you could hear from people about what they wanted to do in relation to CRSV.
But we were actually there to try and interview a woman who herself has a string of acronyms. She is the SRSG CRSV, so that is the Special Representative of the UN Secretary General on Conflict-Related Sexual Violence, and it was Pramila Patten.
Yeah, later this month, she's going to be presenting her annual report from her office on the state of CRSV to the Security Council, and that's, of course, interesting in itself. So you'll hear in the interview how she frames the work of her office and says what she thinks it's achieved in the last 15 years against the backdrop of, you know, multiple conflicts around the world.
But we were also particularly interested in the report her office put out in March about sexual violence in the Israeli-Palestinian current conflict. Now, that report outlined what her team said provided them with, quote, reasonable grounds to believe, unquote, that there had been sexual violence, rape, and gang rape committed by Hamas and other fighters during the October 7 attacks on Israel. And her office said there was also, but, you know, without investigating themselves, credible reports of Israeli sexual violence in prisons against Palestinian prisoners.
And as you'll hear, she was very careful to say that her office is not one of the UN investigative bodies. It doesn't collect evidence, but they say in their report what evidence, what details they relied on. And nevertheless, it is the first UN institution to have outlined the allegations of sexual violence. And they concluded that there was reasonable grounds to believe that the sexual violence had occurred.
A bit of a word of caution from us. We were restricted to 5 questions. And as you can hear, we managed to squeeze in a couple of more. But the questions were also vetted in advance by Patten's team. This is the price of journalism sometimes.
Yeah, I think it's interesting for our listeners to know that sometimes for journalism, for access, you can have constraints. Communications people want to try to control some of the narratives. But we decided in the end that the interview was important enough, and we've left it really long in terms of her answers. Because of how influential Pramila Patten is herself, she helps to define how CRSV is seen, what priority it gets at the highest levels at the UN, what kinds of policies states decide to follow, and how prosecutors actually tackle it.
So we're going to start with Pramila outlining what she thinks her office has achieved. And she's been in her position 7 out of the 15 years that the office has existed. And we asked her also whether there's now more attention to conflict-related sexual violence than there used to be.
Where are we 15 years since the establishment of the mandate? I think we have come a long way. It is a young mandate. Can you believe it that it's only in 2009, for the first time, that the Security Council decided to look at wars through the eyes of women and girls whose bodies have been part of the battlefield since the history of war? And for the first time, the Security Council recognized that women and girls have been significantly impacted by wars through the use of sexual violence used as a tactic of war, and that it was a threat to international peace and security. So sexual violence used as a tactic of war came onto the agenda of the Security Council in 2009. And that same resolution established my mandate as Special Representative of the Secretary General on Sexual Violence in Conflict, tasked to provide coherent and strategic leadership on the question of prevention and response to conflict-related sexual violence, but also to provide leadership to existing UN mechanisms on the whole question of prevention and response, to engage with all parties to conflict, state and non-state actors, but also to engage with civil society organizations and survivors themselves. That same resolution also established the team of experts on the rule of law, tasked to strengthen capacity at national level, to strengthen rule of law capacity of states. As you can imagine, judicial institutions collapse during a conflict. And they tasked the team of experts to support member states and to strengthen rule of law through justice and accountability. Since Resolution 1888 adopted in 2009, the Security Council has adopted 5 more resolutions specifically on conflict-related sexual violence. And the mandate has evolved. So the normative framework has evolved over the years. So that's why today, 15 years down the road, I can say that we have come a long way in terms of a normative framework. A solid normative framework is in place to deal with prevention and response, with the last resolution 2467 adopted in 2019 that really puts the survivor front and center and calls for a survivor-centered approach in both prevention and response, really call for an end to impunity. But of course, the reality on the ground is completely different, that the resolutions on paper are not matched by action on the ground.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I mean, your whole introduction sounded incredibly optimistic. Finally, we've got somewhere. We got 5 resolutions. Everything's happening. And then you just give this twist in the tale to say, in fact, reality is not there.
But I still maintain that we've come a long way, because sexual violence used as a tactic of war has rightly been described as the crime that is least condemned, least reported, one of history's most silenced crime. But today, with that normative framework in place, it is no longer an invisible crime. The numbers speak for themselves. I mean, I have the responsibility of compiling the annual report of the Secretary General on conflict-related sexual violence. And that is the only historical record that you have on the global, I will not say prevalence, because we are not really able to establish prevalence, but incidents, trends and patterns are captured in that report. And because that report only includes incidents that are verified by the United Nations with a very high threshold and with a very strict methodology of verification, the numbers are approximately over 3,000 cases documented in like 21 countries over 1 year. But the report for 2023, for example, which will be debated on the 23rd of April before the Security Council, shows an increase of 49% from 2022. But that does not mean that the number of cases are necessarily increasing, because, like I said, this is a crime that is chronically underreported. And I think today, survivors are breaking the silence, because we have done a lot of work. The office has done a lot of work, even before I joined in 2017, in tackling stigma. Shame and stigma constitute a major obstacle that explains why survivors do not come forward. There are, of course, other obstacles to reporting, but shame and stigma is a main factor. And the office has done a lot of work in that respect. And I think today survivors are more comfortable in breaking the silence, something you would not imagine 15 years ago.
Do you think that stigma is the biggest hurdle to accountability? I mean, you have this whole legal framework, but we saw in Ukraine that while this whole framework is in place, there's a lot of experts. There needed to also be a lot of training on the ground of investigators of how to particularly deal with that type of crime in a war, in a conflict situation.
I really think that shame and stigma is the main obstacle, but it's not the only obstacle. I think fear of reprisal is another one. Fear of rejection, because often you see survivors of sexual violence are struck by the double tragedy of rape and rejection. In many African and other countries as well, the survivors are rejected by their husband, by their families, by their communities. They are banned from the community as bringing shame. So I really believe that shame and stigma is a major, but there's also that fear of rejection. I recall meeting a woman in Bosnia after 23 years, who we had just reported, and she was still very, very traumatized. And she came to me and she said, the government is accusing me of having reported now in order to benefit from a pension, because they had just voted a pension law. And she told me that she did not want the pension and would not even take the pension. And she looked at me and she said, do you want to know why I reported 23 years later? And I said, yes, please go on. And she said, my husband just died. And she said, I kept this on my chest for 23 years. If I had told my husband that I was raped, he would have rejected me. I would have lost him. I would have lost my children. And as he died, the first thing I wanted to do is to relieve myself from that huge burden. So that's how long it can take. And this is what the fear of rejection can do to survivors of sexual violence. So I really think that you have a series of reasons that make it so hard for victims to come forward. Of course, there is fear of reprisals when the perpetrators are walking in the community and there are genuine concerns about fear of reprisals. But you also have lack of trust in the judicial system, insensitive justice system, or when the perpetrators are state actors. Could be the police, it could be the state armed forces, and who do you report to? So all these are factors. In the context of Ukraine, it's not different. I have been to Ukraine like two months after the Russian aggression, and I saw how difficult it was for survivors to come forward. The first time I was in Ukraine, I met with mothers of survivors who told me that their daughters had been raped and left. And they didn't even know where their daughters were. And I met with a lot of service providers who explained how once the area was liberated, they would do door to door. And in each house, there had been victims of sexual violence who did not report. So that's why I urged the First Lady, for example, to use her platform to call on survivors to break the silence by telling them that their silence would be the license of the perpetrators to continue to rape. And I engaged with the president of Ukraine to explain to him that it's great that he's focusing on justice and accountability, but it is also important to create a safe and enabling environment for survivors to feel comfortable to come forward.
You say you'll be debating the 2023 report later in April. 21 countries, you suggested, we've already mentioned Ukraine. Where isn't there enough attention? I mean, we know it's happening in all kinds of conflicts. So where are we not focusing on that we should be focusing on?
Well, it's unfortunate that one conflict eclipses many others. It is unfortunate that headlines fade. It is unfortunate that media reporting is not always about the rape. It's always about bombs. And although there has been a shift, there has been a paradigm shift, and I saw that with Ukraine, but I also see that headlines fade, and that is a pity. But I must call a spade and say that I have also seen how sexual violence can be instrumentalized and sometimes exaggerated, and that does not do justice to anyone. So there has to be safe and ethical reporting. So there is work to be done with the media in how they report. Of course, I encourage the media to report about sexual violence because this is the hidden crime in any conflict. but it has to be about safe reporting. And that's why my office is also engaging with journalists and doing training on safe and ethical reporting. So coming back to your question about conflicts that are eclipsed and on which there is not enough attention, there are many of them. A couple of years ago, we were talking about Ukraine. Today, we are talking about Israel and the 7th of October attacks. But I can tell you that DRC, there is a huge spike in the number of cases since March 2022 with the resumption of hostilities by M23. And we are talking, in terms of real numbers, thousands. But the UN is only able to verify a few of them, maybe 1,000. But when you look at, for example, UNFPA's data for 2022, I had cases like 38,000 of cases of sexual and gender-based violence. I had 32,000 of cases reported by UNICEF. But I used data from the Human Rights Office, and the number was like below 1,000. So it was a huge gap. One NGO, Médecins Sans Frontières, reached out to me and shared their data. And they had something like 674 cases of rape in Eastern DRC in 6 camps over 2 weeks. And who's talking about DRC? And it has not been abated. I mean, we are now in 2024. The hostilities are ongoing. The number of cases are on the increase. There's massive displacement. What I saw last year when I went in July was very, very distressing to see the food insecurity in the camp, to see the choices that the IDP women and girls had between economic desperation and survival for sex, where with a proliferation of brothels in and around the camps and women and girls confessing going there for less than 200 francs, which is less than $1, to buy food and water. The clear choice for them was livelihoods or losing their lives. And no one is talking about this huge spike. What's going on in the Sudan as we speak, with massive displacement of over 9 million people, cases of gang rape and trafficking for the purpose of sexual slavery and sexual exploitation, is rife and being perpetrated by both parties to the conflict, RSF and SAF. It's not at all in the media, but there are other countries like Central African Republic and Myanmar and Somalia, which falls below the radar.
I'm sensitive to what you said about media reporting and how they report and what they report, but also as somebody who reports for the media, one of the things that I always get asked is about figures and how many people can we say have been affected. And I think you also picked up on that. There's a real lack of, I don't want to say lack of credible figures, but it's really hard to get figures that are supported by more sides. And it also seems that there is a lack of coordination on the ground on what people report and how it gets categorized.
Well, because I report to the Security Council, we rely strictly on data that is verified, on information that is verified. But at the same time, it's hard to expect accurate bookkeeping on an active battlefield. You know, for me, it's not a statistical exercise. And that's why every year I say that the report is about incidents, trends, and patterns, and that shows the severity and brutality of the sexual violence, but does not purport to show the actual prevalence. And we talk about trends. For example, in this year's report, we show the impact of militarization. We talk about proliferation of small arms and light weapons and how it impacts on the safety and security of women. Like, the majority of women and girls who are raped are raped at gunpoint. So we highlight these trends. In previous reports, we have highlighted the trend of climate-induced conflict in certain parts of Africa. We have highlighted the nexus between conflict related sexual violence and trafficking for the purpose of sexual exploitation. And in the context of Ukraine, that was the focus of my report last year, to show how trafficking is an invisible crime. And with the massive displacement in Ukraine, both in time and scale, that there was a huge risk of trafficking internally, but also for the refugee population in neighboring countries. The nexus with food insecurity is what I am also highlighting in this year's report. So for me, it's not only about the numbers.
One of the most recent reports that came out of your office, which did attract quite a bit of attention, was into the allegations of sexual violence by Hamas fighters as they attacked various places in Israel on October the 7th, including also some of the allegations of sexual violence that the hostages who had been taken in by Hamas and later released also gave evidence on that to you. And it's really one of the most sensitive reports, I think, that your office has come out with, at least in my experience. I've seen such a lot of commentary around it. I mean, particularly from some people saying, well, basically, there's a lack of evidence. And you were very clear, I think, to say what your evidentiary standard is. And we've been hearing that in every answer you've given. You're very clear. This is what we can say and no further. So the quote that's there is, quote, reasonable grounds to believe, unquote. I think our audience understands what that means, but maybe you could lay that out clearly to everybody. What does that level of evidence mean? And how did you get to that conclusion?
Well, I must say that I did not go to Israel to conduct an investigation. I do not have an investigative mandate. I went to gather, analyze, and verify information on incidents of sexual violence reportedly committed on the 7th of October and its aftermath. I had to do this exercise because there is no UN presence in Israel. And I needed to do this exercise for its potential inclusion in the annual report of the Secretary General before the Security Council.
There's no UN presence?
There's no UN presence in Israel that does this kind of monitoring. So you do not have the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, OHCHR, in Israel. You have OHCHR presence in OPT, in occupied West Bank, in Gaza. And that's the reason why I did not have to do a similar exercise in occupied West Bank, although I went there to engage because I had some information about reported allegations of sexual violence against the IDF and settlers. So although it was not investigative in nature, given the sensitivity of the subject, I decided to, with my technical team, that we would apply the same UN methodology of verification. And we had decided that it would be on reasonable grounds to believe, as is the case for even UN entities with investigative mandate. So what does it mean? It means our own assessment, objective assessment of credibility of witnesses that is verified. So we would require a certain level of verification and corroboration. And in the case of Israel, the verification was more from footage that we saw, from photographic imagery that we had, from interviews. I'll just give you one very concrete example. We have a witness, an eyewitness to an act of sexual violence that happened on the 7th of October, but we interviewed other witnesses. So we did not rely on the single version of one witness. So we sought to have corroboration of that witness testimony, but also backed by photographic images and in some cases, raw footage. So that was the kind of exercise that we did. And that's why with respect to three locations, we came to the conclusion that we had reasonable ground to believe that there is enough information that sexual violence occurred in the form of rape and gang rape. We did not collect evidence, but information. And with regard to most of the other locations, we had circumstantial information that did not reach the threshold of reasonable grounds to believe, but circumstantial information, which was mainly in the form of photographic imagery, of a pattern of women, and in some cases men, being totally or partially naked from the waist down, with bruises, etc., that is indicative of some form of sexual violence. And circumstantial evidence, information meaning that there is no other inference to be drawn except that. So there was a lot of circumstantial evidence that was available. We did not proceed to do attribution because we did not feel it was our task. And we also could not establish prevalence in such a short term. And we stress in that report that even the actual prevalence may never be known because of the fact that many were killed, many victims of sexual violence were killed. And I have not met any survivors of sexual violence of the 7th of October. And the information I had is that there is a handful, but that they were undergoing very specialized trauma treatment, that they were disoriented, they had cognitive difficulty and suffering from survivor's guilt and were not prepared to speak. I don't know the exact number, and there may be others who have not reported because, as you know, there is a huge displacement of the community living in the south of Israel across the country. And that was one of the difficulties that we had also to even to engage with NESSES, because there are at least 200,000 people that have been relocated from south of Israel. So that was the methodology that we used.
And you also visited the occupied Palestinian territories and focused a bit on the sexual violence that Palestinian prisoners have faced and threats of rapes during searches. That again was met with a lot of denialism, and it's a very contested subject. How hard is it for you when state actors don't want to engage with the things that you found out or refuse to acknowledge your reporting?
Well, it's never easy when you are confronted with a denial, because you cannot resolve any issue when there is a denial. But in the case of Israel, I must say that before going on the mission, I had received UN-verified information about reports of sexual violence in the form of prolonged forced nudity, inappropriate strip searches, and threats of rape against men and women in detention settings, at checkpoints, and during house raids. And even before finalizing the parameters of the mission with the government of Israel, I requested a visit to occupied West Bank to engage with the Palestinian Authority, but also to meet with recently released detainees in order to raise these issues with the relevant Israeli authority. And that parameter was agreed. So I did go to occupied West Bank and did meet with a large number of civil society organizations, with the Independent Human Rights Commission, with a number of recently released detainees, but also with relevant line ministries. And I got very disturbing information about threats of rape and also the prolonged forced nudity, which according to me will reach the threshold of conflict-related sexual violence. And I did raise it with the relevant Israeli authorities. There was no denial, per se, at the time that I raised it. But instead, they shared with me that they have protocol in place and that they have a complaints mechanism in place and that reports are duly examined. But I also shared with them the information that I had, that out of some 1,400 complaints, that only 3 were given due consideration and were found to be unfounded in terms of allegation. And that's why one of the recommendations that I have made in my report is to have a framework of cooperation with the government of Israel that would include working with the security sector in terms of oversight to work with them on the allegations received on the other side. So that information will be in the report of the Secretary General, and also information that we have received through UN agencies for Gaza and for occupied West Bank will be in the report of the Secretary General.
We see now in the last couple of days, weeks, a lot of photos flooding social media of Israeli soldiers with all kinds of underwear, posing with underwear reportedly from women in Gaza, that gets touted very much on social media by Palestinian activists as proof of the prevalence of sexual violence in Gaza. How do you, as an expert on conflict-related sexual violence, look at these images, or don't you?
I keep away. I'm very skeptical about social media, especially in the context of this conflict. And that's why I made sure that in my technical team, I had an expert on a digital analyst and open source information who did ensure that the raw footage that we saw, the 50 hours of raw footage and the over 5,000 photos that we were presented were authentic and not manipulated, because this is not my area of expertise. So I needed to get the right expert in my team. So for that reason, I keep away. And for whatever is happening in Gaza or the occupied West Bank, colleagues from the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights will do their verification within the parameters using the right methodology. And I will use their information because I know that I will be basing myself on solid information that has been verified.
And the final question.
Oh, you should never say that, Steph.
What would you want to impress on everybody working with conflict-related sexual violence or people in a position to do something about it? What is the one thing that is important that everybody knows about this type of crime?
Yeah, I was going to ask something similar, because we're actually here at the Peace Palace and you've been addressing this amazing group of prosecutors from around the world. So I'm wondering, what's your message to groups of people like that, that people need to know about conflict-related sexual violence?
Well, the prosecutors who are here are already doing a fantastic job in terms of breaking new grounds and coming up with major breakthroughs, because often we see that their task is very difficult. Sexual violence cases are always considered that there's a huge myth and misconception that it is so hard to prove these cases, that they are not winnable and that the legal challenges are insurmountable. So for me, the message that I have is that crimes of sexual violence used as a tactic of war are not lesser crimes, and that they are preventable, and they are preventable through justice and accountability as a deterrent. And that's why I have made prevention through justice and accountability my number one priority. You have to raise the cost. It cannot be cost-free to rape a woman or a child or a man. And it's only by raising the cost that you will deter these crimes, because perpetrators or would-be perpetrators, they make a calculated decision. They know that these crimes will not be reported and that they will walk away free and that the victims will walk away in shame. And I think we have to break that calculation through consistent and rigorous prosecution. And that's why I commend the work of these very brave prosecutors who are breaking new grounds, who are trying to correct a historical gap of impunity being the norm and justice the rare exception. And I think it's a very determined group of people that we have here converging and working together to make justice attainable. Because wherever I go, survivors ask for justice and reparations, and it is what they receive the least. And they have made it very clear to me that justice is part of the journey to recovery. They never recover unless they know that the crime that they suffered is acknowledged and that the perpetrators pay the price.
When we have time, we do have some standard, what we call our asymmetrical haircuts questions at the end. And the first one is there something that we should have asked you that we didn't get round to asking you? Is there something that you really wish that you'd had time to say?
Maybe on how to prevent these crimes. I have the deep and firm conviction that conflict-related sexual violence is preventable. It's not collateral damage. It's not an inevitable byproduct of war. It's never an accident. And I think by raising the profile of these crimes, there's so much work that we can do together to prevent justice and accountability being one, but also addressing its root causes, with gender inequality, discrimination, marginalization, and poverty being some of its invisible drivers. And one first lesson that I got from survivors that I met in Goma back in 2017, I think it was my first field mission after taking office in June 2017, the link between the physical security and economic security. And for me, that's the powerful lesson that I've learned from these women. And I think by economically empowering women, we can help to protect them against sexual violence. When we see where the sexual violence is happening, it's about women walking to the forest to fetch water or firewood and getting raped. It is about women leaving their children unattended in their homes while they go and fetch water, these kids having no access to education. And when they come, these kids have been raped. So I really think that we have to look to the solutions, and there are ways to resolve this. We can eradicate this scourge. We have to use all the tools that we have, that the Security Council has put on the table, from sanctions. I have seen the value of sanctions being used in tandem with justice, how I have been able to secure the release of no less than 500 women and girls who had been abducted through the threat of sanctions to one of the commander of a non-state armed group. So there is potential. There are avenues to eradicate this scourge. And I am very optimistic that if we all work together, if we have the political will with the financial resources, we can really deliver on this mandate, and we can really look at survivors in their face and tell them that international law is not a vain promise.
And we're here in a room surrounded by lots of law books and all these library books. But we want to know, and we always ask our guests, what is on your nightstand, in your podcast feed, on your Netflix line, if you have that? What do you do that you would recommend to our readers, either work-related or non-work-related?
Well, non-work related would be music for me. That's my way to escape from the hectic schedule that I have and from the intense working hours that I put in. Jazz, but also classical, but also instrument. I love the violin. It really relaxes me, and that's something I strongly recommend. Otherwise, I was a lawyer by profession. I practiced law for 35 years, and I still go back to basics and to law books. For example, preparing for this conference was fascinating because it took me back to the days where victims of rape, not used as a tactic of war, would actually come to see me, precisely because they knew that it would be so difficult for the state prosecutor to prosecute these cases because they never have faith in a case of rape. So they would actually come and see me. Then I would have to go to the director of public prosecution to seek authorization to prosecute the case.
And this is in your home country?
In my home country, Mauritius. So I have appeared in many rape cases for victims, stepping in the shoes of state prosecutor. And I was thinking, if only the state prosecutors in my country could benefit from this kind of gathering. So I have huge confidence in this exercise that is happening over the next 2 days. But I really want to see a community of practitioners emerge from this, where there can be constant cross-sharing of experiences. And it will only be for a good cause, because I think by raising the cost of conflict-related sexual violence, we can eradicate this horrific crime.
Thank you so much for taking all this time to talk to us, more time than we had expected, but very much obliged that you took the time to talk to us. Thank you so much.
No, you're welcome.
This was Asymmetrical Haircuts, your international justice podcast, created and presented by Janet Anderson and Stephanie van den Berg. This episode was produced in partnership with justiceinfo.net, an independent site covering justice effort for mass violence. Music is by audionautics.com, and you can find show notes and everything about the podcast on asymmetricalhaircuts.com. This show is available on every major podcast service, so please subscribe, give us a rating, and spread the word.
Hi, it's us again.
Just to say that if you enjoyed the interview and you want to support our work, head on over to patreon.com and buy us a coffee there.
That way, you also get to hear the extra War Criminals Book Club podcast that we do every month.
And twice a year, we show you a little bit of what goes on behind the scenes. You can meet the team and ask what subjects you'd like us to cover.
And there's a monthly newsletter.
All for just the price of a cup of coffee and a bit of cake every month.
And you get the deep appreciation from our team for your support.
Thank you very much.
Always bloody well getting the last word.
Always.